She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
At more than 70 sites across the country, toxins like arsenic, mercury, and radium are leaching into groundwater from pond-like storage pits filled with the sludgy leftovers of coal burning. Coal is our country's dirtiest energy source, from mining to burning to disposing of coal waste. Could the case be made that coal is literally killing us? Stay with us to find out, and welcome everyone. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and that's what we're going to be talking about for this next hour. Excuse me. Thanks so much for listening and for being a part of our world. And a big shout out and thanks to the sponsor of this show and to a company who is doing nothing but great things for this planet, Tanks Green Stuff. They collect green waste from all over our local community and turn it into some of the highest grade award-winning organic compost on the market today. For more information about Tanks Green Stuff and all that this company does to make a difference for our community and for the planet, please visit them at tanksgreenstuff.com. So needless to say, I'm very excited about the show. And those of you that listen to me week after week know that I don't have shows that I don't get excited about. And this is no exception. This is the second of our five-part series for the month of May, spotlighting women leading the charge to address global warming. We truly believe there is no better moment to accelerate the cause of gender equality than by raising the voices of brilliant women who are creating positive change by doing the good thing, the right thing, for all of us who call the planet home. Joining us for this next hour is Marianne Hitt, director of Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Their campaign is uniting grassroots activists across the country to move America beyond coal. The Beyond Coal campaign's main objective is to replace dirty coal with clean energy by mobilizing grassroots activists in local communities to advocate for the retirement of old and outdated coal plants and to prevent new coal plants from being built. I'm so sorry. It seems when I go on the air, that's when this happens. So, Marianne, thanks so much for being here and for all the work that you and the Sierra Club are doing leading this charge. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure to be with you.
I know. And for the few seconds that we got to talk before we went on air, there is going to be good news. There's really good news in this arena. And I think in this day and age, any good news we can take, I'll take it. Any good news that's out there.
There is so much good news, more good news than we could fill an hour with. So I'm excited to share it with you and your listeners.
So let's start with a basic. I mean, just coal as a technology, isn't it something that's so outdated and that it would be very in everyone's best interest if we said goodbye to it?
Well, I think when most Americans think of coal, they think of, you know, something from, the 19th century, or perhaps they think of coal miners with helmets going into dark tunnels under the ground. The reality is that until recently, half of U.S. electricity was coming from coal, coming from about 500 coal-fired power plants. And we got half of our electricity from coal for decades, and that is a state of affairs that the Beyond Coal campaign set out to change, in part because coal is not just the biggest contributor to climate change in the United States, coal power for electricity, but it's also the biggest source of all sorts of toxic pollution, like mercury pollution, biggest source of very dangerous kinds of air pollution. And so we all have been connected to coal for decades, whether we realized it or not, and that reducing our reliance on coal is the work that we have been making great progress on in the Beyond Coal campaign.
And one of the things that I think we have to keep on reminding people about to raise their awareness and to get them engaged is it's really true that it's making us sick. So can you talk a little bit about that? The carbon emissions, it's not only causing climate disruption, but it's a health, it has an impact on our health. It's not health risk, it's dirty.
Exactly. And the two ways that people are most often exposed to pollution from coal are in the air and in the water. And so, believe it or not, even today as we speak, there are many coal plants, coal-fired power plants, still operating in the United States without modern pollution controls. And so our estimates that are that about 7,000 people are dying prematurely every year in the United States from air pollution from coal-fired power plants, pollutants like sulfur dioxide, which is linked to problems like heart attacks and strokes and asthma, come out of the smokestacks of coal-fired power plants if they do not have up-to-date modern pollution controls. And then the second big exposure comes from the water. So after you burn coal to make electricity, there's this waste left over called coal ash, and it is stored, has been stored for decades in these big unlined pits next to streams and rivers and lakes, and it contains all the pollution that's not going up in the smokestack is ending up in this coal ash, and it's very nasty chemicals like lead, arsenic, mercury, and people are getting exposed to those pollutants in their drinking water. So either the air or the water pollution coming from coal in the power plant has created a lot of health problems. And then lastly, there are health problems linked to coal mining. So people who live near big surface or mountaintop removal mines, again, getting exposed through the air and the water to pollution that is making them and their family sick. And so in addition to the climate problem, the very big climate problem that coal is causing, there are a lot of local public health problems that are linked to coal as well.
So cancer, heart disease, stroke. What about children? What kind of impact is it having on the health of children? I mean, asthma is at epidemic proportions all over the country. Is asthma as a result of toxins in the air from coal burning? What are some of the things that can really hurt our children?
Indeed, asthma in kids and adults living in places that are near, again, these very old uncontrolled coal plants is a very real and a very big problem. And, you know, a lot of my experience working in communities, working with communities where people are living next to these coal plants, oftentimes they don't know what the facility is that's down the road or a couple of miles from their house. You know, a lot of people live in areas with a lot of industrial facilities and don't necessarily know what they are. Places like Baltimore, Indianapolis, Chicago, you know, big cities, and they learn that not only is the coal plant, is the facility up the road a coal plant, but it's lacking a modern pollution control. And it turns out that there's a high rate of asthma in their family, in their community, and that is often has been a big motivator for folks to get involved in the Beyond Coal campaign, because they, you know, they suddenly can connect the dots between the health problems in their community and the coal plant down the road.
You know, I saw a presentation recently from someone from our Department of Environmental Quality at the county, and she had great metrics, and a chart was up, and it was a very engaged audience. Obviously, if you're going to a presentation from the Department of Environmental Quality, you care. And one of the people in the audience pointed out, oh, why is there a huge drop? And I believe that it was in sulfur dioxide, maybe. And it was a dramatic drop on the chart. And the person said, that's the day the Tucson Electric Power Company closed their coal-fired power plant. It was immediately measurable with just instruments that all they do is measure air quality, measure and report. They don't have opinions. So can it be that dramatic the day a coal power plant stops burning, that part of the pollution is over?
That is correct. I mean, coal-fired power plants have for decades been the single largest source of sulfur dioxide pollution in the United States. There was a coal plant in Texas that stopped operating earlier this year called the Big Brown coal plant, and it was the single largest source of sulfur dioxide pollution in the United States. Not the single coal plant, single largest coal plant source, the single largest source, period. And now the second largest source, period, is another coal plant that's operating in the Ohio Valley that is also operating without a scrubber, without modern pollution controls. And so, yeah, these are just behemoth sources of sulfur dioxide, which, again, is a pollutant that's linked to asthma and heart attacks and strokes and very real-world health problems that people suffer from every day, that they may go their whole life and never connect the dots between the, you know, the heart attack that their uncle had or their asthma that their child is suffering from, and a coal plant that, you know, may not even be something they're aware of is 20 or 30 miles upwind from their community.
So we're going to get into this later in the show as to why, even from an economic standpoint, burning coal doesn't make sense anymore. But if there are the right scrubbers and the right controls put in place, is there such a thing as clean burning coal? Is that even a possibility?
Well, in my view, there is no such thing as clean coal for a couple of reasons. One, because you still have to mine the coal from somewhere, and that causes a lot of both health threats as well as environmental problems. You know, in Appalachia, they're blowing up entire mountains to get the coal. In out west, they are ruining the groundwater in very dry and arid parts of the country for surface coal mining. And then after you burn the coal in the power plant, you have this, again, this coal ash. It's actually the second largest solid waste stream in the United States after municipal garbage is the coal ash that's left over from power plants. So it is an enormous volume of this waste that, again, even if the smokestacks are better controlled, all those toxins are ending up in even higher concentrations in the coal ash, which then has to be stored carefully so it doesn't get into the water, which often doesn't happen. And then lastly, the climate impacts of coal. So far, the industry has not really been able to come up with a cost-effective way to capture the carbon and store it. And so while there are some experimental projects out there to see if that can be done, so far, it just can't compete economically with truly carbon-free energy like wind and solar when kind of when it all pencils out. And so, clean coal is an oxymoron. It's a myth. I don't believe it exists, and it especially doesn't, in my mind, make sense to spend huge amounts of money chasing it down when we have wind and solar and other carbon-free forms of electricity ready to go and at our fingertips today.
And there is that expression about you can't put the toothpaste back in the toothpaste holder. When you're talking about arsenic and lead and mercury and chromium, these are things, there's nothing to do with them. Like, they're, once you get that out, and they're toxic and they're harmful. And, you know, sometimes we gloss over in these interviews things like, you know, it's impacting the groundwater. And I want to stop and press pause and shout to everybody, people, get it? Groundwater, our rivers, our lakes, our streams. So you make such a good point that once we mine the coal, there is this massive amount of waste and nothing to do with it except store it somewhere, and then it starts to do the next level of damage and kill and maim and damage, you know, children. So that's my little Mrs. Green rant, Marianne.
Like, well, you know,
listening to, I'm like, what?
I just had the great privilege of being with people at an EPA hearing a couple of days ago about that. We have some very modest standards in place for disposal of coal ash that were put in place in 2015, and the current EPA under Scott Pruitt's direction is trying to roll those back. And so people from all over the United States who are living with coal ash that's not been disposed of properly had traveled to Washington for this hearing, and it was people from the Navajo Nation driving 15 miles to haul water for their livestock, people from North Carolina who've been living on bottled water for 1,000 days, people living in communities where there's a lot of cancer and sickness and contaminated water, and people have a lot of questions for the electric utilities. And, this is a solvable problem to just have a properly lined landfill and monitor, make sure that things aren't leaking out of this properly lined landfill. But the coal operators have never been held to that standard. And so a lot of people have been left with some very dangerous cancer-causing chemicals in their drinking water. And a lot of people have a lot of very hard questions for the EPA. But it is a solvable problem if we would just require the coal operators to do the right thing in the first place.
And, you know, a friend of mine visited me recently from the EPA, and she said what you said, and I don't think that everybody's aware of that. I think a lot of people have a vision of the EPA being this heavy-handed regulatory commission that, you know, organization that just stops development and blah, blah, blah. And the standards are minimal. You know, if you're an environmentalist, she said to me, Gina, these are not harsh, strict, undoable standards. They're marginal. And I think that that's a case that people have to hear about. The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, my passion's coming out.
Indeed. Well, and I think, you know, from as someone who works at the Sierra Club, we are usually pushing the EPA to do a lot more and
right.
set even stronger standards for air pollution and water pollution. But at the end of the day, if you are a mom or a dad and you suddenly learn that there are dangerous cancer-causing chemicals in your tap water, or you suddenly learn that the factory down the road is linked to your child's asthma, who do you want to call? You want to call the EPA. I mean, every American wants to know that the EPA is there to protect the health of their family, and that's why consistently the EPA in all kinds of public polls is, you know, their approval ratings are through the roof from regular Americans, you know, 70, 80, 90% of people who support and love the EPA, because that's who you want to call if you're worried that your water or your air are not safe for your family. And Americans count on the EPA being there and doing their job, and that certainly is under threat these days under the current leadership.
And I have to just do a little sidebar here. If you want to, it literally something happened to me when I went to your website. I mean, I've been at the website before. I've interviewed your executive director. He gave me some time after I met him. But you would get the number one award for most, I don't know, gripping, endearing picture on a website for a bio, because you're there with your little daughter. That's what I was, and I looked at it, and Marianne, I'm not kidding, I said, that's who she's doing this for, and all the other little cuties that are like that. I mean, it touched my soul, and I thought, this is such a great, I don't know, reflection of why our work and raising awareness about this is so important, because her life could depend on it.
Indeed, and I think that's something that I have in common with so many people is that, you know, fundamentally we all want to protect our kids. My daughter is now 8, and she is an 11th generation West Virginian through my husband's side of the
family.
She's
8? Don't ever
she's
change
eight
that
years
picture.
Old. I know, it's too cute. We have
please
to,
don't ever change that picture.
She is a baby in the picture, and she will always be a baby in my heart. But
yeah, it's like people like me need that do this work every day like you. It's like, oh my gosh, that's why we're doing this. Get up and get your big girl panties on and make a
it
difference.
Is.
I know.
It is, and she's an 11th generation West Virginian, and so what initially motivated me to start doing this work was the destruction of the Appalachian Mountains through this type of coal mining called mountaintop removal, where they literally blow up entire mountains to get the coal that's inside of them. And, you know, I feel that is her birthright. As a little West Virginian, she should be able to walk on the same mountains that her father did, and some of them just aren't there anymore. And so, you know, that was initially my entry point into this work, but I have come to realize that many, many people are motivated by fundamentally the exact same thing. And, you know, that could be your child has asthma, your drinking water is polluted. It can be, it's also climate change. I mean, that is why a lot of people are doing the work we're doing that is very successful now to move the country beyond coal, because they see the very safety of the climate at risk for their kids. And that gets a lot of people up out of bed doing this work every day.
So we can get into this a little bit before the break and pick up after it, but there is a very, very strategic, powerful, and focused campaign that you are leading the charge, Beyond Coal campaign, and you have goals. Can you just start by telling us what those three big, bold, audacious, and wonderful goals are?
Well, yes. The first phase of the work was stopping the construction of a wave of new coal plants that were proposed during the George W. Bush years, which was very successful. We're now working to retire, at this point, two-thirds of the coal plants in the United States by 2020 and have enough renewable energy coming online to replace that coal power. And our long-term goal by 2030 is we have a power grid in the United States that is free of fossil fuels. And so it's not just pie in the sky. We are making steady progress towards all of those goals, and look forward to digging into that a little bit more with you, because it's a really inspiring and hopeful story.
And it is so not pie in the sky. When we come back, we will talk about some of the amazing victories and the continued success. I mean, already just in 2018. So everybody, we're going to take a short, really short 30-second break. And we come back, Marianne Hitt, who's the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, is going to talk with us more. I like that expression. We're going to get down in the weeds and talk about some specific examples. And Marianne, I even had to reread three times that the FERC, I've done an on the scene with FERC. I love just saying that, FERC. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission actually denied a deal in West Virginia. You're going to have to talk to me about that. And I'm thinking, what was the behind the scenes going on there? Because FERC, for the most part, does not turn down many requests. Everybody stay here with me. Beyond Coal, is your health at risk? We'll be right back.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy, darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us. We're talking about Beyond Coal. Is your health at risk? And is the planet at risk? And is our environment at risk? And are rivers and streams and lakes at risk? And the answer is yes. Joining us to answer that very important question is Marianne Hitt, director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Their campaign is uniting grassroots activists across the country to move America beyond coal. And a little bit about the Sierra Club. I did interview Mike Brune, who was amazing. I wonder if he ever sleeps. Marianne, maybe you can comment on that later, but he's like, talk about someone who's fired up. The Sierra Club is now the nation's largest and most influential grassroots environmental organization with 3 million members and supporters. And their impressive successes over time range from protecting millions of acres of wilderness to helping pass the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and Endangered Species Act. And more recently, they've made history by leading the charge to move away from the dirty fossil fuels that cause climate disruption and toward a more clean energy economy. Marianne, thanks so much for being with us and for helping us understand a myriad of complex issues. It's great to have you.
It is such a pleasure. I'm definitely enjoying the conversation.
So let's talk about victories. And I do have to get this in. We actually have a president who, despite compelling, irrefutable scientific research about the negative and life-threatening impacts of coal on human health, is boasting about bringing back beautiful, clean coal. And those words did come out of his mouth. Was not fake news. Other than it's almost not to be believed, what is actually happening? Is coal coming back anywhere? Give us a report card on what's going on.
Well, the reality is Donald Trump is not the one making the decisions about where we get our electricity in America, and those decisions are being made in states and cities. And because of that, coal plants are retiring at the same rate under Donald Trump as they did under President Obama, about one plant every 15 days. And those are decisions that are being made by state regulators, by city councils, by state legislatures in some cases. And it's happening for a couple of big reasons. One is this movement that we have built of people in those same states and cities who are pushing very hard to retire coal plants and replace them with clean energy, and making the climate argument, making the public health argument, but also making the economic argument. And so in addition to this very big, powerful grassroots movement, we also have new development, which is renewable energy, is now outcompeting coal in many, many parts of the country, actually most parts of the country. Coal is facing a lot of competition from gas, which fracked gas, which has its own set of pollution problems, but increasingly it's not able to compete with wind, and in some parts of the country it's not able to compete with solar. And so because of the economic competition and the grassroots pressure, we have over half the coal plants in the United States announced to retire. 268 at present out of about 500 that were operating in 2010, and no new coal plants are being built. We stopped 194 new coal plants from being built in the United States during the George W. Bush years. So we're not building any new coal plants. Over half the existing coal plants have announced to retire, and the ones that remain are having an ever harder time competing with renewable energy, which continues to grow like gangbusters. So the future is bright, and the progress is going to continue on the ground, whether Trump likes it or not.
And I always encourage people to go to websites that I love. And if you're sad and depressed about the state of affairs and want to do the happy dance, I would suggest going to the SierraClub.org /coal/ about the campaign. And there's an infographic there that just has to bring a very big smile on anyone's face who cares about the health of our planet, the health of our children, the health of our air. And it's an infographic that shows what you just said. When you see 268 down and 262 to go, you know we have more down than we have to go. It's more than half. And the dirty units retired, that arrow made me really do the happy dance. And when you talk about the dirty megawatts retired, it's very helpful. Let me ask you this. Are there any industry leaders in the coal industry, and I tried to find it and I ran out of time, that are saying, yes, we're retiring them because it doesn't even make economic sense? Is there thought leadership in the industry that's not just about greed and bottom line profits?
Well, there are utilities out there that are acknowledging that the end of coal is ahead of us. In fact, frankly, most utilities at this point, including the biggest, like Southern Company, American Electric Power, have acknowledged that at some date in the future, a date that is too far in the future for the Sierra Club, they're no longer going to be burning coal, 2030, 2050. And so even the biggest and historically most fossil fuel dependent electric providers have started to publicly state that they see an end to the use of coal in their fleet. And for the sake of the climate and for public health, a date of 2050 is just too far out into the future for us at the Sierra Club. So we're pushing them to do more and to do it faster. But there is increasingly this acknowledgement that the long-term future of how we make electricity in America does not include continuing to rely on coal.
So the good news is that the what is working, the what being closing coal plants and allowing all of us to breathe cleaner air. What's driving it at the grassroots level? And I mean in terms of, is it your work? Is it volunteers? Is it local organizations that are committed to the environment? What's the collective will that's happening? Because I'm sure it's not the same everywhere, but what is the driving force, including your leadership, that's actually bringing about these impressive results?
Well, one thing I will underscore is that this is not happening on its own. And I think if you read media stories about the fate of the coal industry, they can chalk it all up to market forces. But I am here to tell you that market forces alone are not making this happen.
Like, that's kind of a joke.
Yes, because these are very powerful entrenched industries that don't want to change. And so that's where we bring all the tools of democracy to bear. So it includes a couple of things. It includes having lawyers and experts who can go into the regulatory proceedings where the fate of a coal plant is being decided and be a voice for clean energy and be a voice for the people on the planet. It's oftentimes they're called state utility commissions or a public service commission. They are the entity where they make a decision about whether a coal plant is going to basically get another round of investment, get another round of life support, or whether it's going to be closed down. And if it is going to be closed down, what's going to replace it? So we have to have our lawyers and experts in those venues, and we have to have our volunteers and our activists outside of those venues making the case for clean energy, including talking to their editorial boards, having rallies, writing letters to the editor, meeting with their elected officials, and making the case that clean energy is here, it's affordable, it's ready to go, it does not have all of the climate and health impacts of fossil fuels, and that continuing to invest in this aging fleet of coal plants does not make any sense. And so it really is, it's local leadership, and it's using all the tools of democracy that we have in our toolbox, including communications, the courts, grassroots organizing, and smart online strategies. And that's one of the reasons that, as a leader of the campaign, that I find the work so inspiring and dynamic, because our campaign in Wisconsin is different from our campaign in Georgia, which is different from our campaign in Nebraska, and it really is driven by the folks on the ground in the states.
And it has to be, you have to keep your foot on that pedal, is your message.
Absolutely.
The pressure.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have huge headwinds coming from the Trump administration, which is trying to prop up coal, and from the coal operators who are trying to insulate themselves from the changing world we're all living in. And activism is really the decisive factor. It's having people who are, again, being vigilant in these decision-making venues, making sure nothing slips by us, no big decisions are there without us weighing in. And also making sure that we're just creating this bigger momentum around, I think people have some outdated ideas about clean energy being too expensive, being unreliable, and the reality is that we have states in this country now that are over 30% powered by wind, on an annual basis. So clean, renewable energy is a big player in this country now in a way that it wasn't a decade ago, and not everybody has heard that story.
And I think that's it begs the question, another point that I have, that's been a dilemma for me in my thought process. So we're looking at record temperatures for this desert. I'm based in Tucson, Arizona, coming up. In a couple of days, it's going to start in the hundreds, 103, 100. Yeah. So it's a very cool day today when we're doing this recording. And I said to my family, get out there, take a deep breath, enjoy it, and then say goodbye, because on Sunday it's supposed to be 103. So
wow.
I want my air conditioning to work. And I admit it. I absolutely admit it. That I
would
want
too
it,
if I were you.
That I want it to work. And
I want my air conditioning to work in West Virginia, and it's not going to be 103.
Right. And it's probably, the case can be, we'll see what happens, but we're going to have a lot of over 100 degree weather in the Southwest this year, extreme heat. Fires are, already burning like crazy in Arizona. So what about for utility companies getting from here to there, meeting the demand to bring reliable, affordable power to us? How fast can they transform from coal, do the transfer from coal to having it do more solar? Our electric company is building solar fields, constantly, and we're beating our metrics for renewables. But how fast can utility companies adapt and get to those numbers?
Well, it really depends in part on where they're located, but also in part on how willing they are to embrace the future. So there's one utility I'll offer as an example, MidAmerican, which is in the Wind Belt, which is on track to become an 85% wind-powered utility. This is a very large utility within the next couple of years because their executive leadership saw the future, they saw where things were headed, and they decided they wanted to be a leader. There are other utilities that are firmly holding on to the past and trying to get bailouts for their uncompetitive coal plants from Donald Trump and his administration, and who, frankly, are First Energy is an example. That's my power provider. They've just gone into bankruptcy because they so refused to embrace the changing world and were so desperately clinging on to these uneconomic coal and nuclear plants. So partly it's what resources are available, but I think more so is the willingness of the utility to embrace the future. And it is changing rapidly. I mean, this is not think about your electric grid, your electricity provider. This is typically has not been an industry that has seen a lot of rapid change, and now it is. And in this decade, we have, we went from half of our electricity coming from coal to a third. We went from basically no renewables to some states having a third of their power now. Some days in California, the vast majority of the power is coming from renewable energy. So integrating all those renewables onto the grid. So things are changing very quickly, and some utilities are leading that change and others are resisting it, and it's a spectrum.
So it can happen faster. We have to just remember that. It can happen
faster.
It's the will, and it's spending the money and being able to say, we're going to do this because it matters. And we might not have the same earnings per share, but...
Well, and I think the utilities that lean into this challenge and embrace it will be the ones that are thriving and profitable in the future. And it's the ones that drag their heels, like FirstEnergy, that are going to have a harder time competing in the 21st century. But it also is up to, you know, to states like California and New York and Oregon that set aggressive targets for clean energy that the power providers have to meet. That in turn drives this innovation that all of us benefit from. I mean, California has a aggressive clean energy target. They are bringing on a huge amount of renewables in order to meet that target. That's driving down the price of renewables, which then benefits everyone around the country and all the innovation that comes with that. So there is a bit of a race now, kind of an economic race, to see who are going to be the winners of this renewable energy revolution. And the states, I think, again, that set aggressive targets and have some political leadership are also going to see a lot of economic benefits.
So there, again, is just hope. I mean, and the price of solar coming down is another one that is just so important to note that it's an affordable option beyond measure.
Absolutely. It's an affordable option. And even if you live in a state like I do, West Virginia, I actually have solar, and I also recently just bought an electric vehicle. So I have a car that is powered by the sun. And even though the solar panels, I did have to put some money up front, they will eventually pay themselves back, I did have to put some money up front to install them because my electric bill dropped pretty dramatically. And so it's here. It's happening. And again, when you think about the headwinds coming from Washington around propping up the fossil fuel industry, the economic juggernaut that is renewable energy is not slowing down, and decisions about where we get our electricity are being made at the state and city level. And those are all things that Donald Trump, frankly, is not going to change.
And that is music to my ears, I can tell you that. And I'm sorry to just be, I have tried for 10 years to keep this show apolitical, and that challenge continues to face me since the election. I mean, it's like, I am what I am, I'm taking a stand, and what's being done out there is wrong. So I'm about doing the right thing and the good thing, and what they are trying to do. I hope people understand there will be things that are done that you can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again, like in Bear's ears. If they devastate that area for uranium mining, it's gone. It's never coming back, and it's going to be ugly and toxic and just beyond awful. So let's just fight those headwinds. Okay, now on the human side, and we might have to, you know, come back to this after break, because I sometimes ask these questions right at the break, but there is a human side to this that I think has been grossly misreported, of the people that actually work in the coal mines. And you read statistics about how their life expectancy, the incidence of cancer, you name it. It is not a healthy, happy life that they get to lead. And yet, it is an income. So what about, do you think there's some type of, you know, the responsibility of all of us to figure out what to do with those people? Because the Industrial Revolution was fueled by coal. That was then, that was the past, it's done. But what about the people who won't have jobs when these plants close? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, as someone who lives in West Virginia, I think that everyone in this country, whether you realize it or not, we stand on the shoulders of people who worked in the coal industry and the sacrifices they made, sacrificing their health, their clean water in their communities, their clean air. And I think the best way to honor and repay that sacrifice and that debt is by, as a nation, investing in building a more diverse economy in those coal communities, and an economy that can sustain the generations in the 21st century, because we all did benefit from those sacrifices, whether we realize it or not. And, they're in a lot of these coal power plants, oftentimes between the date of the announcement of the retirement and the actual retirement of the plant, sometimes 10 or 15 years go by between the announcement and the actual retirement of the plant. And so that provides enough time for some of the workers in the plant to retire, and then others to, these are big electric utilities, and for others to be moved to other jobs within the utility. Not always the case, but that is often the case, that it's sort of a phased-in process. It doesn't result in a lot of layoffs. It is economically hard for the local community because they've relied on that coal plant for their tax base. So there is definitely a need for a thoughtful transition that doesn't leave people behind, and that is something that is ongoing in a lot of places. And then where it's even more challenging is the coal mining areas, because these are communities that have frankly relied on a boom and bust extractive industry for decades, and now trying to chart a new path forward economically is a heavy lift. And that's where, again, I think we as a nation need to be investing in these places, and you know, everything from supporting entrepreneurs to job training to land reclamation. And there's a lot of good work happening. There's a lot of good work happening.
Hold that thought so we don't cut you off. We'll be right back, everybody.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for listening and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. I'm Gina Murphy Darling. Thanks for joining us for the second in a series of podcasts spotlighting women leading the charge to address global warming. We really do believe that there is no better moment to accelerate the cause of gender equality around the world than by raising the voices of brilliant women who are creating positive change by doing the good thing, the right thing for all who call our planet home. And our guest today is one of those brilliant, passionate women. Joining us is Marianne Hitt, director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. This campaign is uniting grassroots activists across the country to move America beyond coal. And the news is good. The news is really good. So, Marianne, sorry that we had to take that break. Sometimes I'm going to stop doing breaks in the very near future because I don't want to break the flow. And what you're saying is so important, that it's, we don't keep doing the bad thing, the wrong thing, so that people can have jobs that are killing them. And if you want to finish that thought, you know, it would be great, because I wanted to hear every word.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think the bottom line is that as we are making this transition from coal and ultimately fossil fuels towards renewable energy, it's critical that we don't leave people behind, and that includes people in communities that have been home to power plants and people in communities that are home to the mining industry for a long time. And I believe that we can do that in this country. We're the richest country in the history of the world. We put a man on the moon. You know, we have made big economic transitions before in industries like tobacco and other big economic shifts we've made. And so I think that that is as part of this work we're doing to tackle climate change and improve public health and not expose people to as much fossil fuel pollution. We need to do that in a way that doesn't leave people behind, and I believe that is something that we can do, and it's certainly something that we care a great deal about at the Sierra Club.
And it's really important for me to just add that you look around and you see charts and read research, real research, scientific research, numbers being counted, economic reports, and what is the fastest growing and most sustainable sector for job growth in the country consistently? Green jobs.
Renewable energy.
Renewable energy. It's like, people, this is a job that stays. It's not like a fracking job where you go on site, you know, rape the and pillage the environment, get a lot of big bucks, and then it's closed down and there's some babysitters. I mean, that's how I describe fracking. Come in, do the damage, slam, bam, thank you, ma'am, to Mother Earth, and we're out of here.
Well, and we have, as a contrast, you know, up in the Northeast, there is a burgeoning offshore wind industry, and there's a huge amount of, literally there's billion-dollar supply chains at stake, and a lot of enthusiasm from organized labor for the opportunity to build these, you know, very, very powerful, big new sources of energy off of the coasts of some of our nation's largest cities. I personally, just a couple of days ago, actually, my husband and I bought a Chevy Bolt, which is the all-electric Chevy. It's American Union made, and we never have to go to the gas station. And we have solar panels on the roof that are now powering our very fun to drive, very zippy and roomy new electric vehicle. And that's definitely creating union jobs here in the United States. So it's creating a huge amount of new economic opportunity. And again, I think that the states and the industries that see that coming and embrace it are going to reap the benefits. And I live in West Virginia, a state where there's more fear. We're more fearful generally about the clean energy revolution. And yet even here, we have very cool solar companies that are actually training people from the coal fields, from the coal mining communities, to become solar installers. So even when the political leaders aren't ready to embrace the future, the people on the ground, I believe, are.
So we can't forget to talk about FERC, because it is West Virginia, and I'm sure you're very familiar with what I'm going to talk about, but when we did, FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is a joke. I'm sorry. It's like I love being able to be the host of the show and say that. It doesn't really regulate much. I think they've denied, maybe this might be the third application in years, and if you disagree with me, that's fine, but didn't they actually deny a deal in West Virginia recently with a utility company?
Yes, there have been a couple of big headlines FERC has made lately, and they've involved efforts to bail out these coal plants that are having trouble competing. One was at the national level. Rick Perry's Department of Energy put forward a proposal that would basically force people like you and me to pay to take electricity from these coal plants, even if there were cheaper alternatives available, and FERC rejected that as most likely an illegal scheme. And then in West Virginia, in a sort of a smaller scale but a similar effort, one of the power utilities, First Energy, was trying to force West Virginia to basically accept the power from this, again, uneconomic coal plant that had been in a different market and couldn't compete. And they figured, oh, well, we'll sort of force West Virginia to take this coal plant because West Virginia is sympathetic to the coal industry, and their FERC and the state regulators will agree with it. And both FERC and the state regulators actually rejected this proposal to force the West Virginia electricity customers to take the power from this coal plant. And that coal plant is now on track to retire because it just couldn't compete anymore. And that's when we talk about the role of advocacy. That's where, you know, advocates played a big role in pushing back against this proposal and in educating all the decision makers about the fact that, you know, even here in West Virginia, we don't want our electricity bills to go up when there are cheaper alternatives available.
And I would love to see some versions of people doing out-of-the-box happy dances that would go viral on Twitter when things like this happen. It's like, I make a joke a lot about doing the happy dance, and I did a video the other day and said, do you want to see what Mrs. Green looks like when she does the happy dance? Here it is, because I actually do. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about, I'd like to ask you two things in regards to the third goal of the campaign, which is keeping coal in the ground in places like Appalachia and Wyoming's Powder River Basin. Why these two places? Why are they a target? And if you can, the second part of that, not related, is what updates do you have or sense do you have of the divest invest movement that really made the news a lot several years ago? And I went to many conferences where they had a strong presence because college kids were putting the pressure on universities to get their investments out of coal and oil companies and to keep it in the ground. So first part, why is your big, you know, the big eye on places like Appalachia and Wyoming's Powder River Basin?
Well, the goal ultimately of the Beyond Coal campaign is to, again, have our power grid in this country running without fossil fuels, and coal was the first and most immediate focus, but we also are increasingly focusing on trying to leapfrog over gas. And when it comes to mining, we particularly, Appalachia and the Powder River Basin have been the two biggest sources of coal in the United States historically. And Appalachia coal production is starting to decline for a couple of reasons. One, because we've been mining it here for 100 years, and so the seams of coal are just more expensive and more dangerous to access. But also because a lot of the coal plants in the eastern United States are now announced to retire, and so the markets for coal just aren't there like they used to be. And so those are two places where there both is a lot of coal at stake, a lot of carbon at stake, a lot of other pollutants that could be left in the ground or, you know, released into our air and water. And a place where the mining also has, in both places, a pretty significant environmental impact, and in Appalachia definitely has a big impact on public health. And ultimately, you know, our goal, again, is not that any one or part of the country is more or less important than the other, but that ultimately we no longer need to dig the coal up out of the ground because we're making energy from the wind and the sun. And we are making very impressive progress in that direction. And again, that's something that the progress has not slowed in the last couple of years. And we are not slowing down in our efforts to make sure that that remains the case.
And, you know, just another good news, we're trying to launch a third show that's called On the Scene, where it's timely podcast, not having to, you know, schedule you 4 or 5 months out because you're so busy. Always great shows. But we had two people on several months ago that contacted us and said it was about a pipeline preview, a review, and it was two women, one from the Delaware Riverkeeper and Maya Van Russum, I think her name was, and Karen Faridun from Burke's Gas Truth. And that's another area where there was good news. They were going to FERC to protest. That's what the first I had ever heard about FERC, quite frankly, and I think there's a reason for that. But it's just to affirm your message of hope and what happens when good people get together to make the good thing happen. It works. We just need more of us, is what I have to say. There are never enough of us.
And wherever you are, there are decisions being made close to you, somewhere close to you, about energy, about pipelines, about power plants, about whether or not it's going to be easy or hard to put solar on your roof or to have more renewable power on your grid. And so you don't have to go to Washington, and you don't necessarily even have to go to your state capital, but you just getting plugged into, and it's not just the Sierra Club. It's Sierra Club, Riverkeepers, Waterkeepers, NRDC, local grassroots environmental right. organizations. It's a network of dozens, if not hundreds, of groups that are all doing this work, and there is a place for you to get involved.
And you can see, I mean, just we are having a teacher strike out here, and the activism, it's encouraging. People are tired of it. They're sick of it, and they're taking to the streets to be seen and to let their voices be heard. Unfortunately, in Arizona, sometimes that doesn't have the impact many of us would like it to have, but we're making progress, and we do keep showing up.
Well, we have that in common. Our teachers here in West Virginia were the first to go on strike and got some long overdue pay raises, and I think also changed a lot of perceptions about West Virginia in the process. We're a very proud state with a very proud history of organizing, and it's really encouraging to see that spreading like wildfire around the country. And I think it's a reminder of you don't have to sit back and assume that someone in power is making decisions you can't influence. And if I've learned anything from the Beyond Coal campaign, I mean, we had accomplished the impossible. You know, when I started doing this work, people said we couldn't stop mountaintop removal mining because we got half of our electricity from coal. It had always been that way. It was always going to be that way. And if we changed it, the lights would go out and everyone's electricity bills would go up. And here we are, 10 years later. We're getting a third of our electricity from coal, not half. It's a historic low. No one's lights have gone out. No one's electricity bills have gone up. And the clean energy revolution has created hundreds of thousands of new jobs around this country. And it happened because of people getting active in their communities and in their states. And it's a revolution. And it's really people power I have seen it accomplish amazing things.
And I hope it accomplishes some amazing things in our state, because God knows teachers deserve to be paid more. In our state, some of them haven't gotten raises for 10 years. And you just say that and you're like, really, is this fiction? Because it is really such a disgrace. What's up? Like, what's coming up? What are some of the big hot on the scene battles that you're facing right now that people should be aware of?
Well, we, in the Beyond Coal campaign, our goal by 2020 is to have 2/3 of the coal plants in the United States retired or announced to retire, and we're not there yet, so there are a lot of very big, high-profile coal plants that are teetering on the edge of closure and getting lots of attention, including some out there in the Southwest, like the Navajo Generating Station. We also have, the continued all over the country advocacy around trying to stop new gas plants that are being proposed and create more space in the markets for more renewable energy. So this work is going to keep happening on the ground, and we're expecting basically an unrelenting attempt at the federal level to try to slow all this progress. So, a couple of big moments coming up in September. There's going to be a global climate action summit in California hosted by Jerry Brown and Michael Bloomberg, where they're going to be bringing together all the commitments that are being made by states and cities to make the case that the U.S. is still in on meeting our Paris climate targets, and that even if the president isn't on board, the American people are on board on making the shift to clean energy. And so that's going to be kind of a culminating moment for a lot of this work, kind of putting an exclamation point on all this grassroots progress. Then obviously we expect to see this at play during the election and even going into 2020. So it's gonna continue to be lots of moments of note. Another thing to watch for this summer is expected release of the new version of the Clean Power Plan, which was our federal climate policy under Obama, basically limiting climate pollution from power plants. And it has been scrapped by Scott Pruitt, and he's going to be proposing a replacement that will come out this summer. And so that's something that I expect will gain a lot of attention and gain a lot of headlines when it comes out.
One can only hope that it scares me to say one can only hope he might be gone by then, because the fear in me is always, and who is going to take his place? It never. Yeah. It's always shocking. It's the devil, you know, sometimes. But in this case, I say I can't imagine a worse choice, but I'm sure there are some out there. So anyway.
Well, unfortunately, the number two at EPA right now, Andrew Wheeler, was a former lobbyist for a coal mining company and is a longtime advisor to the coal industry. So I don't think having him in charge would be much better, but Scott Pruitt has definitely just had this unrelenting string of ethics scandals and, renting apartments from fossil fuel lobbyists and doing favors for them and having all sorts of bizarre security details like a secret phone booth and, being driven to dinner with sirens blaring in a, limousine. So he is certainly leaving a trail of scandals in his wake that indicates maybe his tenure will be short at EPA, but I'm no longer making those kinds of predictions. I just know
me
that...
Me either. I've been wrong so much in the past year.
Yes.
And it's like, and I like to remind our listeners who obviously do care if they're listening to Mrs. Green's World, it's our money. It's our money that he built that telephone booth with, or whatever it was, that soundproof booth so he could talk on the phone.
Yes,
and it's our money for that $30,000 desk. Our money. We might as well have written a check. Why aren't you ticked off?
And these same unscrupulous ethics around, his personal way he's conducting his business extends to the safety of your water and your air. And if you think he's not, handling his own affairs with integrity in his job, then you certainly this is the person who's in charge of the safety of your water. And I think that should, someone with those sort of questionable ethics around how he's handling his business is certainly not someone I would want in charge of whether a big polluter is contaminating my drinking water or not.
Nor would I. So as we get into the last minute and a half, everybody out there, all of you, my wonderful tribe, the people that are just fueling this movement for Mrs. Green's World, check out the Sierra Club. It's sierraclub.org. It's a wonderful website. It's content rich. It's inspiring. Their victories are very clear. And read some of Mary Ann Pitt's blogs. They suck you in. You want to read them and you want to keep reading them. So there's my commercial for you and for the amazing organization that you work for and represent. And our next show is going to be another amazing one. Alexandra Billick, Director of International Displacement Monitoring Center. And it's another one where you go down the rabbit hole and you think, wow, talk about women and children being the first to be impacted by this incredible monster called global warming. Children are being displaced. Women are being displaced. Where are they going to go? What's happening? So, Mary Ann, thank you. This was delightful and inspiring and informative, and I appreciate you and all the work you do. And thank you for that picture that made me smile of your now 8-year-old. And everybody, make it a great green week and check out sierraclub.org. Thanks for being a part of my world.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you.